welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes Hot, Wet, and Uncertain. What do scientists predict the Earth will be like in a few decades? Computer models suggest deterioration of agricultural land, crumbling bridges, flooded roads, and population shifts away from low-lying cities such as Miami and Amsterdam. How fast will the Arctic ice melt? What does this mean for the rest of the world? What are governments and businesses doing in the Bay Area and elsewhere to prepare for new water patterns that paradoxically may bring too much water at times in some areas and drought in others? And then after that, David Suzuki discusses the human environmental crisis and how it could be turned around in a generation.
And everyone has seen the kind of like character assassination that went on around these stolen emails. And now, in fact, sort of the Fifth Commission has just come out and saying that the scientists really were doing nothing wrong and nothing in those emails has anything to do with the validity of climate science. And yet, has that been widely covered? Not nearly as widely covered as the accusations. So it's much easier to make these accusations than it is to defend and explain. And that is a disincentive for scientists to get out there. It's like, well, what do I get if I really get out front? I attract the attention of these professionals whose job it is to make me look silly. And so I think that it's also incumbent upon, I mean, I wanted to thank all of you for being here. It shows your interest in learning about this issue. And then you can also become a communicator and talk about it. And more and more we're seeing people, scientists and in their local communities, people are recognizing, wow, I've lived here for 40 years. You know, it doesn't look like it did when I was a kid. And so that kind of communication I also think is going to be very important, because in the end, science is only a piece of what informs our political process. And in fact, I think the scientific community believes it's a pretty small piece.
And the audience will have a chance to communicate in just a moment. I'd welcome you to line up at the microphone if you'd like to make a brief comment or a question. Though you talk, Andy Gunther, you talk about the panels into panels that reviewed the climate science, and they did say the science was sound, but they did admonish that some of the scientists for not being as open or transparent. So Wieslaw Maslowski, I'd like to ask you if you feel like you're going to be more transparent with your data or more open than you have in the past as a result of this recent episode.
Well, from my point of view, I always respond to any request for data and model outputs, so I don't have anything to hide. And the point is that with being more open and more outgoing in terms of communicating and making your data available, basically the format for peer review publications, at least until recently, has been such that you publish your data, and if somebody wants to do a separate analysis on your data, they definitely should have access to the data. It doesn't mean that the data always is available on the public website for access to anybody, but if you need to look into this data and has been, for example, funded by the National Science Foundation or some other agency in other countries, this data, the legacy of the data is that it should be available publicly to anybody who wants to access it. So it's more a logistics issue rather than just being trying to be secretive and trying to withhold the data from other people. To make a more positive comment on this issue is that more recently many peer review publications, journals, they allow you to add media connection or media links to your paper. So you have a hard copy paper, which most of the time now it shows up on the internet, on the website for that particular journal, and you can actually click on the link, which is a media link, and you can actually access much more information that this paper provides by itself. And this is becoming more and more common, where you can actually basically have access to the data, description of the analysis, actually a description, or even the actual results that are being summarized in the particular paper. Keep in mind that most of the time papers are, you know, several pages, and the amount of information that is actually put into this paper is outrageous. So it's hard to describe everything there.
And Greg, I also have to say that while there have been, maybe there were some data sets or some code, computer code for some models that were not readily accessible, the amount of data, the amount of source code that is available on the internet is extraordinary. And people who are, you need to ask yourself, what information is this person looking for that they don't have? Because I have looked into some of these claims and found them to be completely without foundation. And in fact, people making the claims do not have the qualifications or the skills to even utilize the information that they are asking for. And secondly, one of the criticisms had to do with how the scientists responded to Freedom of Information Act requests, mm-hmm. or that's the American version, though I can't remember the British acronym for the law. I have seen the Freedom of Information Act used as a weapon against scientists who are producing information in which a Freedom of Information Act request comes in to a public university or a government laboratory that requires, in essence, the laboratory shut down in order to make copies of every single data sheet and every single freezer custody record and produce all this information to deliver to somebody. That kind of request was never made in the past. And so there is, part of this has to do with a sense that the people making the requests really have an ulterior motive that is beyond just getting the information in order to conduct an independent analysis of their own.
Andy Gunther is Executive Director of the Center for Ecosystem Management and Restoration. Let's have our audience question, please.
Thank you. A few months ago, I had the chance to meet with Jackie McGlade, who is the Director of the European EPA, and she's also a scientist. And she was talking about climate projects ranging from helping hunters up in Lapland dealing with the effects of the reindeer, like losing their habitat, to designing floating communities in Holland, to protecting the billion investment of the port of Hamburg, to providing drought-resistant seeds in Hungary. So my question is, do you see similar efforts either in California or in our country that is sort of helping communities to build up the resilience against climate change?
Will Travis, resilience is a big word in the adaptation community.
We are just beginning to do that in California, and I think we have an awful lot to learn from other parts of the world. But it's clear we're going to have to we look at it from the perspective that we have to stop protecting San Francisco Bay the way it is now and abandon the folly that we can ever restore to the way it was in the past. And instead, we're going to have to design it for the way it'll be in the future when it has different water levels, different salinity, different temperature, different chemistry, probably different species. Do adaptive management get out in front of the changes that will take place if we're to continue to have a place where we want to live and can live?
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today. So obviously risk is a really big player in this game, and for the financial markets, we need to understand the risks in order to design where we're going to apply capital to have the best and strongest impacts. So do you see much movement or potential movement towards cross-disciplinary partnerships? So a couple times the insurance companies were mentioned as excellent agencies for assessing risk. Is there partnership opportunities between the public and private sphere, between some of these groups that are, you know, have made their specialty really designing the impact and applying that for the scientists? Because as a genetic engineer myself, scientists aren't always the best communicators just as a personality. And so finding ways for us to be able to work with other groups who have a better maybe PR campaign or a better public persona could be very valuable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good question.
I would call your attention to an organization called CERES, CERES.org. And they are working with the insurance industry and in the investment community to develop an overall strategy for investing in an appropriate, resilient fashion.
Yeah, I also think, just to add, that the a key factor for the financial community and the movement of capital is the proper pricing of proper price signals being delivered to our market. So right now it is the market operates with the clear assumption that there is no cost associated with releasing greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. And we know that's not true. And as long as we continue to allow that you know, our quote-unquote free market, which has all sorts of, you know, boundaries placed on it, it's not really a free market, but that the idea that we will not, if we continue that, in essence, subsidy, the future is subsidizing us, then we won't have our experts in the financial world who can help us move capital and use it most efficiently won't have the correct signal about the overall cost of their decisions.
One more comment I wanted to make in response to the insurance industry. Actually, I'm aware, I know people who have been scientists who have been directly funded by insurance industry to do their research, which was of relevance and was addressing some of the key issues for particular insurance companies. So this cross interactions or cross-cutting interest between the scientific community and applied part of it, such as the insurance industry, has been going on, and I believe this is with the climate change and warming might actually get much more increased activity just naturally out of itself.
Lloyd's of London produced a great report 2 years ago called Adapt or Bust. And it's really for the insurance industry, but it's very, very accessible in terms of summarizing the science and talking about the future risk associated with these changes that we're going to see.
Next question, please.
Yes. My question probably should be directed to Professor Maslowski, being at the Naval Postgraduate School. As you know, the United States is the only major country that has never ratified the United Nations Law of the Sea Treaty, which is been suggested by every chief of naval operations and various chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And now that the Arctic ice melt has become a reality, which everybody accepts, I believe, we are really not at the same level for the rulemaking procedures that will be needed once this becomes a major transportation route. And I'm just wondering, is anything happening at your institution to convince our Congress that this is something they should take up very soon?
Well, the Naval Postgraduate School, thank you. That's a very excellent question. I appreciate your bringing this to the agenda here.
I'm a retired naval officer, and I was involved
with
this.
So within the Naval Postgraduate School, we can basically provide scientific expertise advice to the Navy upper-level administration, Pentagon. But it's very interesting that you bring this topic to with this question, because within the last couple of days, the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral, four-star Admiral Roughhead, he was briefing the Senate committee in terms of actually being pro-supportive of signing up the Law of the Sea. And one of the key arguments was made, actually, that if we're not at the table, we're not making any change. So we are just basically a bypasser, and we can make much more change and contribute better and actually turn the situation in such a way that will be more beneficial to our country when we are sitting at a table as a co-signer of this treaty.
Next question. Try to get through the line here. We have about 10 minutes left. We'll try to get through the questions briefly. Thank you.
Galactic level. How does the current climatic change compare to the global warming era around the year 1000 when Greenland became Greenland? And the second part of this is, are there any modalities, given the difficulty in ascertaining somewhat remote climatic data, that such as ice cores, that can help one evaluate this situation?
I guess that's a question to me. First, the 1,000 years, as far as the record goes for the Arctic sea ice, the Arctic sea ice has been around for at least 1,000 years, actually many more thousand years than 1,000 years ago. So the current change and current decline is quite unprecedented. As far as the modality, there are some models, at least I'm aware of several studies, that would suggest that our climate can operate a different, not only one kind of status quo mode of operation. However, that other model scenario definitely will involve some changes in climate in the Northern Hemisphere. There's also connection from what's happening in the northern polar region in the Arctic to climate over Asia, monsoon system. And actually, part of the reason, at least to my understanding, why countries such as Japan and China are very heavily involved in studying the Arctic climate is that there is a strong belief and strong evidence in publications that changes in the high north will affect the weather and climate in Southeast Asia, at least, the Pacific Rim side.
Next question, please.
There's a study came out, was recently published from MIT, which was publicized a few months before that, predicting 5 degrees, sorry to speak in Fahrenheit, 5 degrees Fahrenheit of warming with economic and governmental action, and 9 degrees Fahrenheit of warming in this century without it, and that's not counting outgassing from the permafrost. There are other discussions that seem to be coming up around the fringes of the IPCC, at least, about the possibility that we might be in a runaway situation and that we might actually be moving to a new climate mode that will be quite different to what we have now, and that some of that will happen quite fast. Do you have recent work that addresses this, and how do you see that affecting the next IPCC report?
Well, personally, I'm not in business. Personally, my group, my research is trying to understand the processes and what happened in the past in the Arctic up to the present. As far as the study that are suggesting, definitely a quantitative change if we don't do nothing compared to if we start reducing the greenhouse emissions. I'm aware of actually one very recent, last year publication by Washington et al., where they used the U.S. NCAR, National Center for Atmospheric Research, CCSM model, to look into the this 21st century scenario when we start decreasing the greenhouse gas emissions, and clearly there is a significant change that has been simulated, modeled by those studies through the end of the century, comparing the scenario if we continue business as usual compared to if we stop, maybe go back to like late 1990s concentrations, or maybe even much more reduced. So definitely there is evidence based on model studies that are suggesting that if we start changing our activities in terms of emission of greenhouse gases now, there will be significant change that will be measurable at various levels.
Rieslaw Maslowski is a research professor at the Naval Postgraduate School discussing climate change at Climate One. Next question, please.
Yeah, we spoke about making the climate change problem as small as possible for ourselves and our children, and we know with the more greenhouse gas pollution we put into the atmosphere, the more severe impacts, the more costly, the more difficult it will be to cope with the impacts that come, and that some leading climate scientists, including James Hansen of NASA, have said that we need to reduce carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from a current level of about 390 parts per million to about 350 in order to restore Arctic sea ice, avoid truly kind of unacceptable consequences for ourselves, human society, and the planet. And so I'm wondering about, I don't think that those messages about that we need to read about the risks that come along with different concentrations of greenhouse gases and the need for immediate and deep cuts in greenhouse gases right now, I don't think those messages are getting across like they should be to the public and policymakers, and I wonder if you could comment on that.
Andy Gunther?
I mean, part of the issue here has to do with the fact that we operate with a pretty significant discount rate in our world, and so future benefits are discounted to a very small amount compared to present benefits, and that's something that we have grown to accept, and we are now in a situation where we have really strong confidence that we know something about the future, and that we know that what we're doing now is influencing that. So communicating that, you're also fighting the natural tendency of humans to put off or discount things that are in the future. And thus people talk about their children or their grandchildren and what we're bringing to them. And I mean, I tell people that if we don't get busy, the only thing we're going to be able to do is ask for our children's forgiveness when they're our age. And yet that you're saying that doesn't seem to be getting through. And I think that a lot of people are beginning to think that we, in order to have more effect, we need to talk more about the evidence that we can see right now, and then build that. But I also think part of your I just like comment that the importance of individual action cannot be overstated, in my opinion. Some people say, oh, well, what difference do I make? But one of the things that happens if you take individual action is that you realize it really wasn't that hard and that you can do more. And I think a lot of people now seem to be operating in a fear zone where the answer to this question involves drastic reduction in their economic well-being and their lifestyle, when in fact there are a lot of changes that we can make to begin to bring the curve over. We have a lot of work to do. We have a long way to go. But individual action is absolutely the start.
We have 3 minutes and two questions. Let's try to get through this. Yes, sir.
Thank you. One comment. I totally agree with the notion that those who have their foot in two grounds, science and government agencies, can play an effective role. As an ex-scientist and today as a professional engineer working with the state of California, before coming here, I was trying to encourage one of non-believer of effect of climate change to come with me. And he said, no, you won't be able to convince me. He always referred to this graph. You might be familiar with the Vostok Ice Core studies. And I promised to him that when I'm here, I would bring this point to the attention of the speakers to see whether they can provide me with the answer, how this issue can intensify the effect of those people to be non-believer.
Let's do this really briefly. If you want to talk to him offline, you can do that to give him the response he needs.
I'm not sure if I recognize the
figure.
How about
we look? You guys can meet up afterwards, and then we're going to go to the next question, please.
I believe Vostok Station is from Antarctica, right? So the Antarctica changes in warming has been quite different recently over the last decades compared to the northern hemisphere. The point probably that this person is trying to convey is that we've seen the variability and warming in the Earth climate in the past millennia and millions of years ago. My response to that, I've seen this argument and I've responded to this argument before, is that millions of years ago, we didn't have billions of people populating the coast. So if we had a sea level increase by a couple meters, nobody has noticed. Thank you.
No one's Florida seafront condo was affected. Last question, please.
A lot of our officials seem to be stymied by the fact that we're in this financial crisis and don't have any funding for any of this re-engineering of coastlines and all. Is there any possibility that we could have a transaction fee on financial just things so that there would be some funding? It could even be a penny on a dollar just to get some funding coming into the government that could be distributed for all these projects that need to be done urgently.
How are we going to pay for all this? Tough question. Let's go. Will, you deal with governments who...
Well, I think the important thing to note is what Andy pointed out earlier. This isn't an expense, it's an investment. And for every dollar we invest now, hard though it may be to find that dollar, it'll save us $4 to $5 to $6 in paying for the damage and responding to it later.
Andy Gunther, last word.
I think that it's really, I would encourage everyone to recognize that scientists are a very conservative lot. And they don't get any benefit from projecting beyond what their data support. And particularly with regards to sea level rise, if you go back and read the last IPCC report, you will find that the projections in that report are now, they might even be less than the current minimum thinking. The maximum then is less than the current minimum thinking now. And so I would encourage you all to recognize that that's an inherent part of science. And the idea that there's some sort of global hoax that's being perpetrated that started with Svante Arrhenius in 1896 when he proposed the theory of global warming is so beyond the pale and has such a poor understanding of how the scientific process and the scientific community operates. And if we get lulled into thinking that somehow this is just a game people are playing, we're going to find ourselves in a very, very deep hole with not a lot of time to build a ladder to get out.
But it'll make a great film called Hot, Wet, and Uncertain.
Wieslaw Maslowski, last word.
Okay, in a closing, I want to just say that definitely I do agree that scientific research requires much more resources. But it's not just necessarily new money, but it might be more than, I hate to say that, but, you know, changing the money in terms of the relevance of the societal within the country, within the state, within the county, as a matter of fact. What's more important to this particular region, then let's try to focus our resources on that particular question and have scientists try to help us to address. But I wanted to close, actually, on more, I don't know, optimistic and forward-looking message, saying that, to me, we can also, and this administration, this current presidential administration, I believe is going that direction. We're not exploring and taking advantage of free energy, which is sun. And I'm saying that the sun can start running our cars, but definitely sun can be used to heat our houses. And that we're in the 21st century, and we're fighting wars for fossil fuels, exporting it, and going through a major headaches to get these fossil fuels here and use it, burn it, basically. And we're not ready to take advantage of free energy. This is quite surprising to me, and I believe that efforts should be in parallel to try to mitigate and get ready for climate change as it's happening, to basically shift our technology and the focus to start using energy that's available without much of a headache just involving technology. Thank you.
Wieslaw Maslowski is research professor at the Naval Postgraduate School. We've been discussing climate change also with Will Travis, Executive Director of Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and Andy Gunther, Executive Director of the Center for Ecosystem Management and Restoration. I'm Greg Dalton. Thank you all for coming to Climate One today.
And now for something completely different.